too much credit.
Thank you again to the Rosen Sox for hosting us once again. Much appreciated. Okay, tonight, the title of this year is Dreidels, Jelly Donuts, and Electric Menorahs. So I think we'll touch on all three of those. There's only a lot to say about electric menorahs. And dreidels a little bit. Jelly donuts is not much to say. So we could start with that. And then I figure just to touch on a few different interesting questions and some halacha lemaisa, just very practically about lighting the menorah and some different shapes of the menorahs and various Hanukkah halachas. So we'll start. We can start with jelly donuts because there's really not much to talk about. There is a minhag, there is the custom brought down in from some places, I didn't see exactly where, that we have a custom to eat things with oil on Hanukkah in order to help us remember the miracle, which was primarily with the oil. Now, as we all know from Shul on Shabbos, there are two miracles of Hanukkah, and the main one that we celebrate is the one of the oil, in which in reality seemed to be the smaller and less significant of the two miracles. The real major miracle seems to be more the war. Historically, it seems to be more of a major miracle when you have a group of yeshiva guys taking on an entire army. So that seems to be a much greater miracle. But nevertheless, our celebration seems to focus on the miracle of the oil. And because of that, we do a lot of things with the oil. We light the menorah, that's one. And another thing that people say we do is that we eat things with oil in it. And that's, I think, a lot of people have a custom to eat potato latkes. Latkes have plenty of oil. And that's also why jelly donuts, which I also think is made with oil. There could be some deeper meaning about the jelly donuts of the insides and the pnimius of the Torah. I didn't see that written anywhere. If I had to come up with a reason why we eat jelly donuts, it would sound something like that. Something that I would probably tell you I don't really understand what that means. But it would be something about how, you know, Hanukkah represents the pnimius of the Torah. And Hanukkah represents the Greeks tried to make us forget the Torah, as we say in Al Hanisim, Lashkicham Torah Secha. They tried to get us to forget all of the Torah. And through the Nes, through the miracle of Hanukkah, we have all of this Torah. And there, it is brought down. We light 36 candles on Hanukkah. It's not including the shamashes. But if you count just 1 through 8, on every night we light 36. And some say that corresponds to the 36 mesechtos in Shas, the 36 tractates in Shas, in the Gemara. So you see, there is this connection on Hanukkah specifically, where the Greeks tried to make us forget the Torah. So Hanukkah is the reestablishment of the excitement of Torah and the depth of Torah, the pnimius of the Torah, which is maybe why we eat specifically not just any donut, but a donut with a filling in it. Right? Then it wouldn't matter if it's jelly or custard. It wouldn't matter. I'm not sure it does. I didn't see anything about it. But if anybody sees anything or heard anything, you let me know, because I'm curious as to why everybody thinks we have to have jelly donuts. But I'm not against having jelly donuts, certainly, but nevertheless, I don't know exactly what the reason is, except for the oil thing. So that's jelly donuts. Electric menorahs. Let's take a little time to talk about electric menorahs. So electric menorahs are basically five issues that I found that deal with whether you can use an electric menorah for your menorah, to light for Hanukkah. So we'll go through them. The first one is just a general question as to electricity and the candles, the bulbs, whether it's really considered fire. We spoke about that last week in the context of Havdalah, as to whether an incandescent bulb, a fluorescent bulb, what is considered a flame, what is considered a fire. And this was a whole big machlokas, a big discussion amongst the poskim in the middle of the 1900s, the beginning of the 1900s, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, the Chazon Ish, and Eretz Yisrael. They were having this whole big discussion about what is the Isser on Shabbos of turning on a light. That was a big discussion. What is electricity? What is the prohibition of turning on a light on Shabbos? So the Chazon Ish said that he was the big posek in Bnei Brak. He said that it was a problem, Mida Oraisa, a Torah prohibition whenever you connected an electric circuit of bone, of building. It doesn't mean that connecting the circuit, finishing this, closing the circuit is building, but rather it means when you have an appliance or a light bulb, we'll say, which is off, and there's no electric current going through this this electric machine or light bulb or fan, whatever it is, he basically is he explains basically that it's as if it's broken. It's as if it's not usable, it's broken, and by me turning on the switch or pressing a button and turning this machine on, that basically fixes it. That basically builds this thing, and now it's as if I built it, and therefore it is a Torah prohibition of building. Not everybody agreed with that. There are some who still say like that, and therefore in the Navrak, if you go into a Kolo, they do follow that opinion, and if somebody is wearing a hearing aid, they'll follow the opinion and they won't talk to the person. And so there are those who go with that explanation that the isser of electricity, whenever turning anything on, is bonet, is like you're building by fixing this thing.
Would the hearing aid still be an issue? Because I mean, wouldn't the circuit be on somewhat all the time, and it's moderating, changing the amount?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry I mentioned it. Yeah. No, you're right. It's we'll talk about maybe perm time, we'll talk about hearing aids or something. Right? Like McGill readings, things like that. But yeah, you're right. It's not so clear exactly with hearing aids, but there is what to talk about. But there are those who disagreed, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach disagreed with the Chazon Ish, and he basically felt that regular electricity, there was no Torah prohibition at all. And the only time you come onto a Torah prohibition on Shabbos of using electricity is when there's a heating element that you turn on. For example, an incandescent light bulb. An incandescent light bulb, or let's say you have an electric oven or one of those burners, an electric burner. So there where there's a heating element, so then Shlomo Zalman Orbach thought that that was a Torah prohibition of making a fire, of making a flame. By having something which is burning hot, and this is a question that we've shown them, when you're burning metal, is that bishul, is that making a fire? Mm-hmm. Whatever the Torah prohibition is.
The Gemara says it's mad here.
Yes. Well,
so you light a something until it glows.
Yeah, so there's a question, there's a machlokas in the Raivin and the Rambam, whether it's mavir or whether it's bishul. But regardless of what you say, everybody agrees it would be a Torah prohibition. By having the metal glow to the point where it's glowing, as our incandescent light bulbs do, so that would be a problem on a deraisa level. However, according to Shlomo Zalman Orbach, anything which is not a heating element, an electric utensil or electricity, which does not have a heating element at the end, would not be a Torah prohibition. It would be probably a rabbinic prohibition. Possibly a molid, which is the Rishonim talk about, that there is a new rabbinic prohibition of creating something new. The Gemara talks about spraying perfume onto a garment and giving this new smell to the garment, so that would be prohibited on a rabbinic level because of molid, which is creating something new. You can't create anything new. So there is a rabbi, the Beis Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Shmelkis, I think, who wrote that all electricity is basically creating something new. When you create an electric current and you now have this current running through something, it's an isser of molid, of creating something new, which is only an isser derabbanan, which comes into play in certain circumstances. But Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, it's not clear exactly what his conclusion was. It certainly was that if you turn on an incandescent bulb, it would be an Isser Deraisa, because you're making a fire. And if you put on something without the heating element at the end, so it's only an Isser Derabanan. It's only rabbinic law, whether because of molid, because you're creating something new, which is rabbinic in nature, or just because it's like Bonem Midrabanan, meaning he agreed with the Chazon Ish a little bit, but not totally. So it's not clear exactly what his conclusion is in those areas, but certainly we assume that it is a problem. Now, coming back to what we're talking about, the electric menorahs, so I don't know what type of light bulbs they have. I assume the newer ones probably have fluorescent light bulbs, and the older ones probably have incandescent light bulbs, as is everything now. So the fluorescent light bulbs, we assume basically they're not a flame. They're not fire. As we talked about last week, you wouldn't use them for Havdalah because there's no heat there, and therefore they're not considered a flame. So you can't light it for your Hanukkah menorah if you need to light a candle. Lahadlik ner shel Hanukkah. So fluorescent bulbs probably certainly be out of the question. The question is the incandescent ones. So So the incandescent ones, if we assume that, like we spoke about last week, we quoted Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim Ozer Grudensky, who used to specifically go out of their way to use their incandescent light bulbs to make Havdalah on, to prove to everybody that they really thought this was a fire, and that you should, that it's a Torah prohibition to turn it on Shabbos, then follow that logic through, then it should also be okay to use for your menorah, because it's still a flame. So if that was the only issue, so there'd be room to use it. But there are some more.
Is that the criteria for Nair, that it has to have light and it has to give off fire? And it has to give off heat?
It's a good question. What do you mean for Nair?
Well, for a candle, we're talking about, you know, what's usable for a candle.
Yeah.
For various purposes. And you said, well, you know, the fluorescent would not be valid because it doesn't give off heat. Well, why does it have to give off heat? Where does the definition come from?
Right. So it could be, it's not, giving off heat is just maybe not a definition as much as it's just, it kind of shows that it's a flame. The fact that it's a glowing piece of metal means that this metal is burning. Right? There's a piece
That's
of metal
thing.
On fire.
I mean, it's glowing and it's giving off heat. It's also, it's getting consumed.
Well, so that's the question, if it's getting consumed.
It doesn't get consumed.
So slowly it does.
Yeah.
I mean, finally
everything
it breaks.
Everything it burns.
Yeah, so that's also, they talk about that, whether you need to light something for the menorah, for the candles, the Hanukkah candles, do they need to be something which is consumed?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what people, some say, therefore electric menorah should not be good. But like you're saying, others answer, no, it is getting consumed. That little wire, that filament that burns and glows, it finally does get consumed. That's how they burn out. They finally break. So once you see that they're getting consumed, they get consumed very slowly, but they do finally get consumed. So it's a good question as to what's considered a flame. The fluorescent bulbs, from what I understand, they're just gas, which is moving very quickly, but it's not actually anything burning,
mm-hmm.
anything, right? So the metal is burning. It's a burning hot piece of metal. So you need the burning, because that's how we know there's flame there. That's how we know there's a fire there.
Well,
that's
you're saying burning, but I mean, we know something. You know there's a flame. If I'm standing over here,
yeah.
and I'm looking at a flame from over there, I know it's a flame because I see the light, and I see the movement, I see
mm-hmm.
it jumping. You know, I don't feel the heat from over here.
No, I don't have to feel the heat,
right.
but there's heat there. If I went closer, I'd feel it.
So, right,
there's
it happens
there.
To be.
It happens to be fire creates heat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if that would be a criteria, though. Meaning if you had a fire, which somehow, miraculously, did not give off heat,
right.
so then it would still be,
that
I think
that's
it probably
question.
Still be a flame. Probably. Maybe not. But the fluorescent bulbs are just, the gases are moving very quickly, so there's no flame there, it's just something glowing. Or you can have something glowing without it being a fire. You can't have something burnt hot, but I mean, maybe you can. Probably nowadays you can create some type of special heat. Right?
Yeah.
Don't they have those foods that you just kind of open the pack,
right.
pouch and...
Yeah, the Milmar things. Yeah.
Right. The travel meal.
Yeah.
So you're right. So you could have that, but that also wouldn't be considered a flame. A flame would be something which is burning. Something which is, and burning, I don't mean hot. I mean something which is glowing. So you have a glowing filament. That's how metal is on fire when it glows. A piece of wood is on fire when there's fire on it. A wick is on fire when there's fire on it. But yeah, the fluorescent bulbs, it's just the glowing of the chemicals, the gases. So that's not considered a flame. But fine. So let's assume now. Let's work with only an incandescent bulb, the regular light bulbs, because that's the only one we have a chance with. So there are a few other issues. One of them is that the Gemara tells us that you can't use an avuka, which means a torch. You can't use a torch for your nearest Hanukkah. Why not? So the Gemara, I'm not sure if the Gemara says this, no, I don't think the Gemara says it, but others explain the reason is because then it's not obvious that you're doing it for, that you're lighting it for Hanukkah. And the whole purpose of lighting the menorah is that it should be clear to everybody that there was a miracle, that a miracle happened with this oil. So if you light this big flame, this big torch in your house, no one's going to think that, oh, they're celebrating some miracle that happened many years ago. They're going to say, you wanted to read your book, so you sat, you lit your flame, you wanted to have your dinner, so you lit this big torch in the corner of the room. No one's going to think, it's not obvious, it's not clear to anybody who's looking in, that is for the mitzvah of Neros Chanukah. So some say that you could apply that then to electric light. Because an electric light, if I were to just turn on this light and I say, oh, I want to use this for my menorah, you'd say, who knows? If you walked by the house, you wouldn't think that the menorah, that you did this for the menorah. You'd say you wanted to eat your dinner here. So you put the lights on. The problem with that is, no one's going to think that about your little electric menorah in the window, right? That would be true if you're using a regular light bulb. But if you have one of those little menorahs with the orange light bulbs that you screw into the electric menorahs in the window, so no one's going to think you're lighting that because you want to use it to eat dinner. You put on your regular lights. So that wouldn't be an issue. And that would also, some say, there's no presumenisa, there's no publicizing of the miracle. But again, that wouldn't be the case if you're actually using one of those menorahs, which is obviously for the purpose of the miracle. The other two issues, which are possibly a little bit more serious, one of which there are a lot of answers for, and the other one is a little bit more questionable. One is that the halacha is that you need to, when you light the menorah, there needs to be enough oil in the cup that it should last for the allotted time, right? Let's assume, we assume basically that it has to last for a half hour after nightfall, so there has to be enough oil in the cup, or your candle needs to be big enough that it will last for a half hour, right? So there are those, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach wrote this, that he said that when it comes to electricity, when you turn on the light, there's nothing there, right? There's no electricity built up, saved up in your wires, or however this is working, that will make sure that this will light for the next half hour. The electricity is constantly coming. It's constantly coming, but there's nothing there that you're lighting.
Unless you're using solar panels.
Unless you're using solar panels.
Batteries.
Or generator, or batteries.
Or
he says batteries would be better.
Well, generator.
A generator? I don't know how
everything,
generator
everything, all the electricity is coming from essentially a big generator. You have a turbine that's burning either coal, gas, natural gas, or heat from a nuclear reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It's running, you know,
so
running
coming
the power.
From some generator.
Yeah, everything's
right.
Coming from
so
somewhere.
So he also seems to be worried about a power outage.
Well, maybe that's more in Israel years
right.
ago than today.
Well,
right.
Then you'd be worried about winds blowing out your flame also. It's
so
the same issue.
We are worried about that. That's why...
That'll concern both ways.
We are worried about that. That's why we light. That's maybe one of the reasons why we might light inside nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Or why you have to buy one of the little glass boxes if you're in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's in order to keep it safe from the wind. Because otherwise you're not lighting anything if you know it's going to go out. But yeah, so that's what he thought, that maybe this is like you're lighting an empty cup. And it's as if you're just every moment putting a little bit more oil.
Well,
so if I sat there, if I had an empty cup that I lit, and then I put a little bit more oil in every 3 minutes, that wouldn't be okay. I'm not yotzei my mitzvah of lighting the menorah if I have to put in more oil every 3 minutes. I'm yotzei if I light a cup with enough oil that it will burn for a half hour. But if it's lighting a cup with a little bit of oil and then 10 minutes later I have to add some more oil to make sure that it keeps going, then I'm not yotzei. So he thought similarly in electricity. When you put on the electricity, there's nothing actually there that you are lighting, which will be consumed. It has to continuously be sent from wherever it's being sent from to make sure that your light goes on to light. Now, others disagree, and they say, first of all, we're not worried about nowadays electricity stopping because it's early during the winter, right? We never have blackouts during the winter. During the summer, maybe, when everybody's running all of their appliances and their air conditioning. But during the winter, certainly, the chances of having a power outage in the middle of the winter are very small. And then they say the same idea, that the difference between the two cases that he tried to compare, that the case where I have a cup of oil with a very little bit of oil that I had to keep adding oil to, as opposed to the electricity is constantly on its way. It's constantly coming. It's as if, like Yeshua said, that it's as if it's connected, like, you know, the generator over there is like our cup of oil. And just because it's not here in front of me, they say, so what? It's connected somewhere, and that is constantly coming. And it's as if I'm just drawing the oil from there. It's not like a cup of oil that I have to take from the pitcher of oil and pour into the pitcher. No, it's as if I have a big cup of oil over there with some type of straw running from my cup to that cup, and the oil is constantly coming in, the electric current is just constantly coming through.
So would that be valid, Rabbi? If you had a menorah with eight cups,
yeah,
and you had a big jug of oil, and then you have little wires that's feeding the oil slowly. So you don't have a half hour worth in each one, but you have, you know, 3 hours or 4 hours worth in a big jug, and they're all feeding off that. Would that be valid? Would that be a kosher menorah? Because that's an equivalent analogy to what you're
right.
the electric menorah.
But it's all coming. Meaning it
it's
will
all coming.
Come.
It's all coming, but you don't have, each candle does not have a half hour's worth. They're all drawing
but
from the same
does,
supply.
But it does, because it's connected to that supply.
But they're all drawing from the same supply.
So you're saying, and then incrementally it opens, the door opens up in increments and it lets a little bit more oil in.
Right.
So that's a good question.
I mean, like a leak, when you say if you connected it before together, right, it becomes like a kliyef at one kli, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that the case, like, right?
Yeah, with the ostrich egg.
But if you connected it, then it would be like
There we're not worried about you taking it out. Once you connect it, it's stuck on, so you can't take anything out or put anything in. But I don't know. I have to think about that. But here it's constant. Here the electric current is constant. Meaning in your case, if it wasn't that it was stopped, meaning you have your oil, a little bit of oil, and you have the straws going in. Now, if it constantly was coming through...
Yeah, just constant drips. Constant, gravity is pulling it
through. Not drips. There would have to be a constant flow.
Okay, so a constant flow.
So then
gravity.
It's all connected to that big jug.
Right.
So then probably yes, because you do have it there. It's just, it's in this big jug.
But then you're dealing with an issue. Is it one candle or is it...
Right, well, you can cover it.
Right, well, that's what I'm asking.
No, so eight candles, because they're all in separate...
But they're not, because they're all connected with one.
Well, they all right. You're saying they all have one oil source,
right? They're all
but they're all still connected. Source. They're all separate things, but they're still separate flames.
But how's it different from you putting in a little bit at a time?
Because I need to do
the manual labor involved.
Yeah, there's something that has to happen. If let's say I lit this and walked away for 3 hours, what would happen?
Okay.
It'd be very different.
Right.
So if it was constantly going in, so then it's when I light it, it's. I don't do anything to it, and it's even, not only do I not have to do anything to it, but nothing has to happen for this to continue lighting, because it's connected to the oil source.
So I don't understand the problem with the electricity then, because there is a finite source, like it's much more than a half hour, and maybe it's hundreds of years, but there's a finite limit of what the energy that's stored up.
Yeah.
So it'll run out eventually, and we're just drawing out of that into the electric menorah.
So you're saying it should be fine.
Yeah.
Right.
If the other example destroys,
right?
Okay.
Yeah, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach thought that it's not there. I mean, you're right. I don't know what he would say about the straw example. He didn't think that lighting the light here, it's as if you're constantly pulling the electricity. He didn't think the generator was like your cup of oil.
There is a difference in that.
Yeah.
In
I don't
when it works with a battery, as opposed to a battery, with a generator, the electric company is actually at any given time producing exactly enough electricity for whatever the demand is.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they have to match demand.
So they're refilling the cup for you.
But the electricity does not exist. In other words, they don't store electricity. So like in the middle of the day, they have to generate more electricity. At night, they generate less. And that's
why...
One of the big issues is when you have something where you have electricity, like let's say a hydroelectric or something like this, renewable energy that you want to use all the time, what do you do when you to store it? So some people, they actually have things where they pump up water to a high point and then they generate electricity off of that water, so that in a way it's storing mechanically the electricity that was produced. But you can't inherently, the way it is structured, the electricity is at any given time being produced to supply, to mass supply.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to oil, which is sitting there, and you're taking something, either gas or coal, and using that to generate, turning it into electricity.
Right. Okay. So you're saying maybe it is a good question.
It is a little different,
right.
But
I mean,
unlike
right.
there is
right.
on the other hand.
Right.
We can move over to the battery example and see why battery.
So no, the truth is, so he himself wrote, or I saw in his name, that he thought a flashlight was better because it has a battery. You have to know if the battery still has a half hour's worth of life left in it, but that a half hour's worth of life in a battery should be better because it's right there in front of you, as if you have the oil all there. So, yeah, he does say that. So if you have a battery-operated electric menorah, I don't know if they make them, but if you had a battery-operated electric menorah, you would certainly get around this problem. Because then you wouldn't have any problems of the electricity. Now, the last problem that's dealt with is whether for the mitzvah of lighting the Hanukkah candles, maybe you need a wick. Maybe there needs to be a wick together with something which is being consumed. And the reason for that would be is because that's what the miracle was. The miracle was with a wick, presumably, with a wick, and it was with oil which was being consumed. There are those who disagree and say, first of all, this is a wick. Right? Who says that the filament can't be treated as a wick? Right? The halacha is that all wicks are kosher to be used as the wicks for the menorah. So why can't the filament be considered a wick? If you're going to tell me that the burning filament is considered a flame, so then let the filament itself be considered a wick. So that's what some say. And others disagree with the whole premise that you need a wick for the mitzvah of Neros Chanukah, because who said it has to be exactly like it was in the Beis HaMikdash with the... According to that, we shouldn't be able to use wax.
Or a chanukiah, we should be using menorah.
We should use menorah, right. Right. Well, the chanukiah is for the 8 days for
okay,
the
miracle.
You're
going to
try to right, you're right. No, so they would say it has to be the same tzura. It has to be the same flame, the same type of flame, which is also how they'd answer my question about not using a wax candle. Because a wax candle is a very similar flame to an oil candle with a wick. It's just a little bit of a different material that's being burned and consumed, but nevertheless, they're similar in the fact that they're both a flame. So anyway, those are all the issues. Lamaisa, halacha lamaisa, I didn't see anywhere that anybody said that you should use it with a bracha. Meaning, nobody says that if you have an electric menorah that you can make your bracha of lahadlik ner shel Chanukah on that menorah, because of any one of these issues. Everybody was, but there were those who said that in a case where you had no choice. For example, let's say you're in a hospital and you can't light any flames in your hospital. So there are ways around it. If somebody is, you know, they could have their spouse light for them at home, and that would fulfill their obligation of the menorah. But let's say a person in the hospital, he's nobody light for him, he doesn't have him at home, and he's stuck in a hospital and he needs to light the menorah. So, and they don't let you light candles in the rooms. So then some say that, yeah, get yourself an electric menorah, light it without making a bracha. Because the bracha is not ma'akev, it doesn't prevent you from fulfilling the mitzvah. So at least you're doing something which, according to some, is a fulfillment of the mitzvah. I didn't see anybody who went as far to say that you can make the bracha, but I did see those who say that if you're in a situation where you have no other choice. I do know one Rav who told a friend of mine that if he is away at a hotel, on Hanukkah, he lights an electric menorah in his room without a bracha. That gets into the question as to whether you can light in the lobby of buildings, but we're not going to get into that now. Which is a whole separate question.
Regarding the hospitals, isn't that how women light the candles Friday nights with that electric?
Yeah, so, but that might be better because there aren't as many questions on Friday night. You may have the question of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach about the electricity, although it's unclear if there's actually an amount that needs to be there for the Shabbos candle. You don't have the question of that you may need a wick. You don't have the question of the Pirsumei Nisa. You don't have the some of these questions fall away when you're dealing with the lights for Shabbos. So
if
you have an incandescent set of light bulbs, or even one incandescent light bulb for Shabbos candles, that would be better.
So I remember I was there once with my wife, and I was trying to explain to her what we needed. I said the filament. She said, "Oh, you mean the electric Shabbos candles?"
Right.
Right.
So yeah. So that's what
they. Yeah.
Oh, so there you go. Right. So yeah, that would work.
That you do make a bracha.
That you would make a bracha. Yeah, as long as they're an incandescent bulb. On a fluorescent bulb, I wouldn't make a bracha. But on an incandescent, there are those who would make a bracha even on a fluorescent bulb for Shabbos. For Neros Shabbos, there are some who say even on a fluorescent bulb. But that doesn't seem to be the majority. I'm not sure, but so I wouldn't say that yet, but on an incandescent bulb for Shabbos, yeah, that seems to be more acceptable.
It sounded really like, I mean, there were a number of problems, but it sounds like you could make a kosher electric menorah.
Yeah, you can make a case for it, for sure. Yeah.
That would have problems. That's battery operated.
And I'm trying to answer all the questions, so not everybody would agree with all these answers. Mm-hmm. They're not my answers, but I'm saying, you know, I'm presenting you all of the questions and all of the answers that are given by different opinions.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So even if you create this battery operator, let's say you set up your flashlights in order. It's the fourth night, so you take out four flashlights and you put them on your table. So yeah, according to some, that would be good.
Okay, so I'm not getting a spot in Eichler's next to the kosher lamp with this product. So no market for it.
Well, you never know. I mean, there's a market apparently for the ones that exist now, so you're making A kosher one. I don't know if I'd call it the kosher one.
It's more expensive.
It's more kosher. Well, you just need batteries. Why is it more expensive? You just need a battery.
Batteries, and I think they're using LEDs now. So
oh, they are.
Yeah.
Oh, LEDs.
Yeah, of course. Why not?
Why not?
They last 100 years. So people
right.
Can
yeah.
It's
yeah.
cheaper if you don't use LEDs.
Yeah.
LEDs in this
yeah, we're down to 10 cents in LEDs. It's not a big deal.
Really?
So I don't know if it's a great business move. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not ready to give my hashgacha, so I'm not sure it would help if I did, but for your sales, but fine. Okay, so that's electric menorahs. What else? There is a question about using a circular menorah, right? Different shaped menorahs. The question about a circular menorah, question about one where the arms are not straight, but rather some are in, some are out, and some are up, some are down. So the Trumas Hadeshen was asked about a circular menorah. So the Shulchan Aruch talks, the Gemara talks about a plate with a bowl with a few different wicks coming out, which is what we referred to, that if you have a plate with wicks coming out and you just light it, it doesn't count for anything because it just looks like a big torch that people use for light. If you put some type of plate on top of it, which then separates everything, then it counts for one light. So that's what the Gemara says, the Shulchan Aruch passing like that, and the Ramah adds in, but you can light in something that he referred to as lampas, which I assume means some type of lamp, where everything is separate. So if you have even a circular, sounds like a circular menorah, but each one is a separate cup or a separate hole for the candle, so that the Ramah says is fine. That is kosher, but the Mishnah Berurah, Chavetz Chaim, quoting the Taz, the Magen Avraham, all the commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, they all say that it would be better still not to use a circular menorah, because it's not beautiful. It's not a hiddur. It's not the best way of doing it. It would be kosher. If that's all you have is a circular menorah, it would be okay. It would be sufficient, and you can do it, and you can make a bracha on it, but it's not the best way to do it, and I assume the reason is because for a few reasons. First of all, it's not exactly the type that we think of a menorah. We think of the straight menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. Second of all, one of the reasons why the machlokas in the Gemara as to why we lighten the way we do. 1 to 8, as opposed to the machlokas in the Gemara, Beis Shammai says you start on the first night with 8 candles and you go down to 1. Beis Hillel says you start with 1 and you go up to 8, which is obviously what we do. And there are 2 reasons given. One of the reasons given is because it's supposed to be clear how many days are in how many days. What are we holding by? What day is today? So if you look, if you have it's on the 5th night, you have 5 candles there. It's very easy to see. Oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If you have a circular menorah, I assume it's a little bit harder to count the candles because if you're looking in from the outside, all you see is a ring of fire. It's hard to see them separately. When you have a menorah and you see them one next to the other, it's a little bit easier and clearer, so therefore that creates a little bit more of a better persume nisa, a better publicizing of the miracle. But nevertheless, a circular menorah would be fine as long as the ikar hadin, not preferable, but fine, as long as there are separate cups. Then the straight line, if it's not in a straight line, you have one this way, one that way, one this way, one that way. So again, the Maharil, who's quoted by the Ramah, says you shouldn't, because it looks a little bit like the Madura, which is the torch, which is the circular menorah. But according to that, if this not straight line menorah each had their separate cups, it should be okay, because if the circular one with its own cups is okay. And the reason why the one not straight is a problem is because it's a little bit like the circular one. But if that one's okay with the separate cups, then this one also should be okay with the separate cups. Again, maybe not lechatchila, maybe it's not the best way to do it, and you should have a menorah with the straight. It's better that it should be straight, some say. But it's hard to say that you can't use it and that it would be puzzle and that it wouldn't be a fulfillment of the mitzvah. And then they talk about if there are different heights. If the menorah is, one's lower and higher, lower, higher, lower, higher, so there is a discussion about it. There is even one opinion who says that it should specifically be that the first one is the lowest, the second one's a little bit higher, the third one's a little bit higher, and it should be going up. The reason is because the Gemara, when it quotes Beis Hillel's reason that you go from 1 to 8, the second reason the Gemara gives is because Ma'alin Bakodesh Ve'in Moridin, that we go up in holiness and we don't go down. So this opinion, Mahari Bruna, says, therefore our menorahs should be going up. The first one should be the lowest, and then every night it should be a higher and higher candle. But Rav Moshe Feinstein said, I mean, there are others, the Chayadim, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, they all say that it's better that it should all be even, they should all be straight. But Rav Moshe said that it doesn't need to be exactly the same height, right? If you have a menorah that, you know, it's been through a few years of in and out of wherever you keep it. Maybe the kids found it a few times and dropped it a few times, and now nothing's exactly straight. So that's fine. Moshe Feinstein says that's fine. As long as it's basically, you know, basically the same, basically straight, you know, l'chadchila, it should be exact. You know, you should take out your ruler and your protractor and make sure everything is 100% straight. But l'maisa, it's unlikely that everything is perfect. And it's all, you know, all of these menorahs are fine. The best types are the ones that are straight and all the same height. What else? There's a whole discussion of where you light. So I guess we'll spend a few minutes talking about that. The Gemara says that you should light outside. The Gemara says you light outside by the entrance of your house, the entrance of your courtyard, on the left side, on the other side than the mezuzah. But the Gemara then goes on to say that at the time when there was a sakana, when it was dangerous to have the menorahs outside, so they said you light on your table and that's enough. And that's the end of the Gemara. The question is what happened after that, right? The question is when the Gemara said that you light inside in time of danger, so nowadays, let's say, we don't live in a dangerous time. So should we be lighting outside now, right? Nowadays, we assume in America, you know, as mentioned, the Medina Shel Chesed, we live very peacefully here. We live with a lot of rights and the ability to live peacefully amongst all our neighbors. So I presume that we wouldn't be in trouble if we lit outside. So should we be lighting outside? In Israel, the custom is, most people's custom in Israel is to light outside. Because, you know, it's not a time of danger, and the rabbis there say everybody should light outside. So the question is, why don't we light outside, right? It's more of the burden of proof is on us. The custom in America, and from what I understand in many places in Chutz La'aretz, is to light inside. The question is, why don't we light outside like they do in Israel? So there are a few explanations. Rav Yashiv, who's a Rav in Eretz Yisrael now, so he explains that it doesn't only mean when there is a present danger, but if there is a potential danger, that if we lit outside, it could potentially lead to a dangerous situation, then also you should light inside. So in many places, people are nervous that if everybody lit outside, that may create some negative feelings towards us, or more negative feelings towards us, and therefore, he says, you should light inside rather than see if it would provoke any anger from neighbors. There are others who say that we're worried that our neighbors might blow out the candles or they might steal them. Those are what some say. There is one opinion who says that once the Gemara said you should light inside because of danger, then it means that you should specifically light inside forever, and you should never go back outside. Now, there are those who feel very strongly against this opinion, because he says, where does it say that in the Gemara? All the Gemara says is, now you should light outside, but now that there's danger, so now you can light inside. It doesn't say anything about after the danger. Presumably, once the danger is removed, you should go back to lighting outside. But there is this opinion who says, no, once the Gemara ended the conversation with light inside, that was the end of the story, and therefore you should light inside. The Aruch HaShulchan, quoting a few different shittos in the Rishonim, says that once, like we mentioned, we live in nowadays, when Hanukkah is during the winter, so we live where it's very cold, it's rainy, it's windy, so we're worried that if we light outside, it'll blow out the candles. It'll blow them out, it'll put them out with the rain. And he didn't feel that the Rabbanon meant that we should have to then buy some type of casing to protect our candles from the elements, from the natural elements. There are those who disagree. Obviously in Israel, it's also windy, it's also raining, hopefully, this time of year. But they obviously say, no, you should have to buy a casing, which everybody has there. They have the casing, these glass cases, which they sell pretty cheap. And you light your menorah out there, and that protects them from the wind. So those are the different reasons given. There's one other one that, since the people have been doing it for such a long time, since we've been lighting inside for such a long time already, So then we should just continue lighting inside it because it's become such a strong minhag, such a strong custom, that it would look bad for all of the earlier generations if we were to change it now. And once it's become the custom, then we should just leave it. And Rav Shlomo Miller, who is a Rav in Toronto, said that, I saw it quoted, that he said that it's not the custom to light outside in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Moshe Feinstein also said that you should light inside. He said you should light by the window facing the outside. So if you have a window facing the outside and you're lighting inside, it's better to light in the window for the people walking by to be able to see and publicize the miracle to them. If you don't have a window facing outside, so you have nothing to do, you put it on your table or you put it somewhere where at least the people in the house will be able to see the menorah and the candles. There is one deeper reasoning that I found. It's quoted in the Bnei Yisachar. He quotes the Olos Ephraim, who I don't know who the author of the Olos Ephraim was, but he explains that the Gemara says that when there is a time, when there's a generation where the Torah is chaviva, where the Torah is beloved, and it's very strong, the Torah is very strong in the generation, then it says pazer, it means spread out. But if you see that there's a generation where the Torah is not so beloved and the Torah is not treated so nicely, then kanes, you should gather in. And so the Olos Ephraim explains and applies that to Hanukkah, right? What that would mean is when everything is good and everybody is treating the Torah with respect and following the ways of the Torah, so then you can all spread out and go and do. But when it's difficult and there are a lot of people who are not listening to the Torah, not following the Torah's ways, so then just kanes. Everybody should worry more about what's going on inside and to strengthen the home, to start from almost like the inside-out approach, to start and focus on the home, start and focus on the inside. So he applies that to the Neros of Hanukkah. He says, when the generations were living and the Torah was very strong, so they lit outside, pazer, go and show everybody. But at the time when the Torah is not so strong, and unfortunately when there are many Jews who are not following the ways of the Torah at all, so then kanetz, then you should bring it in. You should bring the focus on the inside of your home. Focus on strengthening the house and strengthening the family and building from the inside out. So he says, so then at a time like this, we would bring the menorah to the inside so that it should be mainly for the family. So that's just a little bit of an extra explanation as to why we would light inside. Okay, so let's talk about dreidels, because I did put that on the title, so we'll talk about it a little bit. Why do we play the dreidel? Where does this minhag come from, the custom of playing with the dreidel? So I saw there are two explanations I found for why we play with the dreidel. The one was that when the Greeks, as I mentioned, the Greeks, one of their goals was to have us forget the Torah. They wanted l'hashkicham Torah sacha, they wanted to make the Jews forget the Torah. So what the Jews did in those days was that they would learn Torah, but they would have to hide it from the Greeks who were looking around and making sure nobody was learning. So they would be playing dreidel on the side and really learning Torah. But they would look like they were playing dreidel, so if anybody came, they'd quickly take out their dreidels and they'd spin the dreidels. And because of that, to commemorate that what they did in those days, we also play with a dreidel on Hanukkah. It's just to kind of cover up for their learning Torah. The Bnei Yisachar is quoted as giving a different explanation, and he contrasts the dreidel on Hanukkah to the grager on Purim, right? The dreidel on Hanukkah and Purim are always connected because Hanukkah and Purim are our two rabbinic holidays that we have. And all the other holidays that we have are Midaraisa from the Torah, but Hanukkah and Purim came after the Torah, so those are our rabbinic holidays, so there's always a connection between the two. But the Bnei Yisachar says that it's not by chance that on Hanukkah we spin the dreidel and on Purim we spin the grager, right? If you have one of your classic gragers where you hold the bottom and you spin it on top. And he says that there was a difference between the way the miracle of Hanukkah happened and the way the miracle of Purim happened. And those are expressed in the spinning of the dreidel from the top as opposed to the spinning of the grager from the bottom. And he explains that on Hanukkah, there was no mass tshuva of the people. And the way that the miracle happened of Hanukkah, that the Jews defeated, a small group of Jews defeated this entire army of Greeks, was from an isarusa dila'ela. which means an awakening from above. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu from above just gave us a tremendous miracle, even though we didn't deserve it. The Jews didn't do tshuva, they didn't fix their ways, they were completely assimilated besides with this small group, and the only reason why it happened was because it came from Hashem. It was an Isarusa de la'ela. The Hisarus, the awakening, which brought about this miracle was from above. And therefore on Chanukah, we spin the dreidel from on top. As opposed to Purim. On Purim, after all of the Jews, or at least the Jews in Shushan, but all of the Jews, it seems, were sinning and seemed like almost going to be destroyed, there was a massive tshuva movement. Mordechai and Esther began an entire tshuva movement of the people, and the people themselves did tshuva in order to merit the miracle of Purim. So therefore, on Purim, when it was an Isarusa de Litzatza, which means a Hisarus, an awakening from below, so therefore on Purim, we spin the Grager from the bottom, because it represents that the miracle came out of the actions of us on the bottom, as opposed to on Chanukah, the miracle came out of a kindness of Hashem from above. And therefore on Purim, we spin the Grager from the bottom, as opposed to Chanukah, we spin the dreidel from on top. Now, I saw an interesting explanation as to why we have the letters, what letters we have on the dreidel. Right? We have Gimel, Shin, Nun, He. Those are letters we have. I know in Israel they have Pe in place of Shin, but I didn't see any explanations for that except for Neith Gadol Hayah Po as opposed to Neith Gadol Hayah Sham. But I'm saying in a deeper way, I didn't see any explanations for the Pe. I found an explanation for the Gimel, Shin, Nun, He. And that also the Bnei Sosfer discusses, and he explains that the Gimel Shin Nun He corresponds to the four different attributes of man. There's the Koach HaGuf, the physical, which is obviously the Gimel, the Seichel, which is our mind, which is the Shin, the Nefesh, which is the spiritual, which is the Nun, and then there's this general overall Koach that a person has, which is Hakol, referred to as Hakol, which is the He. And these four different parts of man, the physical, the intellectual, the spiritual, and then the general koach, so those were all corresponded to in the four different golios that we had, the four different exiles that the Jewish people went through. Each one, Rome, Bavel, Yavon, and Madai, each one corresponded to one of those different parts of man. One was for the physical, one was for the intellectual, one was for the spiritual, one was for the general. And the nullification of all four of those exiles is through the coming of Mashiach. And Mashiach in Gematria is the same as Gimel Shin Nun He. Gimel Shin Nun He, which we have on the dreidel, which corresponds to these different parts of the man, which corresponds to the four different exiles, equals Mashiach in Gematria, and it also equals Hashem Melech, Hashem Malach, Hashem Yimloch. And therefore, when we spin the dreidel, we spin it on one point. It has four different sides, each one a separate side, completely separate, but it comes to a point on the bottom which it spins on, which represents Klal Yisrael. Because everything, all of these things are going around and around and around. And time is always going around this one point in the center of the universe going around Klal Yisrael. And everything is happening to the Jewish people. We're surviving through all of these different things, that all of these experiences, all of these exiles are going around and around the Klal Yisrael in the middle. And ultimately what continues to exist and what in the end what stands on its own is that one point, the Klal Yisrael. And all of the nations of the world will ultimately come back to recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the king and unite with that one point on the bottom of the dreidel, which represents Klal Yisrael. So in this dreidel is such depth and so much, it represents so much, which is, and it's a kid's game. Now just also one other point about the dreidel. And it's a little bit of a kasha, and I don't know. I grew up playing dreidel. So the gimel meant you get everything in the middle. The hay means you get half of it. The nun means you get nothing. And shin, you have to put in one or two. It depends on how big of a gambler you are. One or two. But apparently, in the svarim that I saw, I've been playing wrong my whole life. And apparently the rules are the gimel you get everything, the hay you get half, and the nun is nothing. Those are all right. But the shin, the way I saw it quoted, the shin you get to spin again.
So how do you fill up the
pot? Yeah. I don't
know.
You have to start. Yeah, the ante is more. Exactly. So the ante is more. So, and the explanation I saw for it is as follows. That there are four different types of people. There's a tzaddik gomer, a completely righteous person. Then below him, there's a tzaddik she'enu gomer, a righteous person who's not completely righteous. He has half sins, half mitzvos, but he's still righteous. The third type of person is a Rasha, a wicked person, but a Rasha she'enu gomer. He's not completely wicked. He can still do tshuva. He still has another chance to do tshuva. And then finally, there's the completely wicked person who is already signed and sealed to go to a place none of us want to be. So those are the four different types of people. And they say that the four different letters on the dreidel represent each one of those four. The gimel is obviously for the tzaddik gomer, the completely righteous person, and therefore when you get a gimel, you get everything in the pot. You get the entire, everything in the middle, you get to take because that represents the completely righteous. Then the tzaddik she'enu gomer, the person who's half mitzvos, half sins, so he is the hay, which is why you get to take half of whatever's in the middle. Then the Rasha she'enu gomer. So apparently, a Rasha who is not completely wicked, he's wicked, he has more sins than he has mitzvos, but he can still do tshuva, he's called a Rasha. And the person who is completely wicked, who is signed and sealed to go to Gehenna, he is called a Ra, without the shin. He's a Ra. So the shin represents the Rasha who is not a completely wicked person, he still has a chance to do tshuva, and that's the shin, and therefore you get to spin again. You get to have another chance, because it means that even if you're not such a great guy, you don't do so many mitzvahs, you still have a chance. You still have the chance to do tshuva. And that's what the shin represents, so you get to turn. You get another turn. But a Rasha, Gomer, who is the Ra, he is the Nun, he is completely wicked, and the Nun stands for Nisht. He's done. He's finished, and you get nothing. So that's, apparently, that's how they used to play the game in the times of the Mikrobalim. That each one represented some other different type of person.
They spoke Yiddish back then?
Yes.
Yiddish.
Apparently. Mm-hmm. Apparently.
Yiddish is older than even we knew.
Not from where you came from. They played it differently there.
Played differently, right. Maybe by you, they put for the shin, they put in. I don't know. Anyway, so you can teach your kids the new rules or the old rules, or you can just let them play as they are. Just a word about Moe's Tzur. So Moe's Tzur represents also, it's similar to the fact that we mentioned that the dreidel represents the four different exiles. So Moe's Tzur is also singing about the different exiles and how we are triumphant through all of these different exiles. It is quoted by the Shla and the Trumas Hadesh and the earlier source. Those are the earlier sources I found for singing of Moe's Tzur, at least parts of Moe's Tzur. And they say that Rav El Yashiv, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach in Yerushalayim, everybody used to apparently sing Moe's Tzur together with their families for the purpose of making this mitzvah something which is beloved. And because the nace of Hanukkah is something which is so beloved to us, which is clearly an act of kindness from Hashem, so we try to create a certain sense of beloved, and it's clear, all kids love Hanukkah. They get so excited by seeing the menorahs, and you see there's a love for this mitzvah. There are some who I saw that on Shabbos, you know, on Erev Shabbos, we're in such a rush to light the menorah before Shabbos, and we're in such a rush to get to shul, and it's such a short day anyway, so to have to quickly sing Moe's Tzur before you run to shul is very difficult. So there are some who sang it during their meal together with their other zmiros. Instead of just quickly running through it before Shabbos on their way to catch mincha in shul, or to catch Kabbal Shabbos in shul if you'd have mincha earlier, so there are some who waited to sing Moe's Tzur at their table, because Moe's Tzur is exciting, it's a happy, supposed to create a certain level of chavivus, of love for the mitzvah. So if you're just quickly getting through it, it's not going to create anything. But if you then sing it afterwards, when you sit down at your Shabbos table and you still see your menorah lit and you can still sit together with your family to sing Moe's Tzur, to celebrate the miracle of Hanukkah, so that's what they quote. Rav Stipler, Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky had this practice, and his son, Rav Chaim Kanievsky in Bnei Brak, also apparently has this practice to sing in a little bit more of a joyous and festive time and manner. Okay, we'll stop here. Everybody should have a Freilich of Hanukkah.
Oh,
Hanukkah. Oh, yeah. Is different. Enjoy your